The Death of Ivan Illich by Lev Tolstoy. Edited and licensed for text-to-speech by FreeClassicAudiobooks.com. Copyright 2004. Chapter 1. During an interval in the Melvinsky trial in the large building of the law courts, the members and public prosecutor met in Ivan Igorevich Shebek's private room, where the conversation turned on the celebrated Krasovsky case. Fedor Vialevich warmly maintained that it was not subject to their jurisdiction. Ivan Igorevich maintained the contrary, while Peter Ivanovich, not having entered into the discussion at the start, took no part in it, but looked through the gazette which had just been handed in. "Gentlemen," he said, "Ivan Illich has died."
"You don't say so."
"Here, read it yourself," replied Peter Ivanovich, handing Fedor Vialevich the paper still damp from the press. Surrounded by a black border were the words, "Praskovya Fedorovna Golovina, with profound sorrow, informs relatives and friends of the demise of her beloved husband Ivan Illich Golovin, member of the Court of Justice, which occurred on February the 4th of this year 1882. The funeral will take place on Friday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon." Ivan Illich had been a colleague of the gentlemen present and was liked by them all. He had been ill for some weeks with an illness said to be incurable. His post had been kept open for him, but there had been conjectures that in case of his death Alexeyev might receive his appointment, and that either Vinnikov or Shtapel would succeed Alexeyev. So on receiving the news of Ivan Illich's death, the first thought of each of the gentlemen in that private room was of the changes and promotions it might occasion among themselves or their acquaintances. "I shall be sure to get Shtapel's place or Vinnikov's," thought Fedor Vialevich. "I was promised that long ago, and the promotion means an extra 800 rubles a year for me besides the allowance. Now I must apply for my brother-in-law's transferred from Kaluga," thought Peter Ivanovich. "My wife will be very glad, and then she won't be able to say that I never do anything for her relations." "I thought he would never leave his bed again," said Peter Ivanovich aloud. "It's very sad." But what really was the matter with him? The doctors couldn't say, at least they could, but each of them said something different. "When last I saw him, I thought he was getting better. And I haven't been to see him since the holidays. I always meant to go." "Had he any property?" "I think his wife had a little, but something quite trifling." "We shall have to go to see her, but they live so terribly far away."
"Far away from you, you mean?"
"Everything's far away from your place. You see, he never can forgive my living on the other side of the river," said Peter Ivanovich, smiling at Shebek. Then, still talking of the distances between different parts of the city, they returned to the court. Besides considerations as to the possible transfers and promotions likely to result from Ivan Illich's death, the mere fact of the death of a near acquaintance aroused, as usual, in all who heard of it the complacent feeling that it is he who is dead and not I. Each one thought or felt, "Well, he's dead but I'm alive." But the more intimate of Ivan Illich's acquaintances, his so-called friends, could not help thinking also that they would now have to fulfill the very tiresome demands of propriety by attending the funeral service and paying a visit of condolence to the widow. Fedor Vialevich and Peter Ivanovich had been his nearest acquaintances. Peter Ivanovich had studied law with Ivan Illich, and had considered himself to be under obligations to him. Having told his wife at dinner time of Ivan Illich's death, and of his conjecture that it might be possible to get her brother transferred to their circuit, Peter Ivanovich sacrificed his usual nap, put on his evening clothes and drove to Ivan Illich's house. At the entrance stood a carriage and two cabs. Leaning against the wall in the hall downstairs near the cloakstand was a coffin lid covered with cloth of gold, ornamented with gold cord and tassels, that had been polished up with metal powder. Two ladies in black were taking off their fur cloaks. Peter Ivanovich recognized one of them as Ivan Illich's sister, but the other was a stranger to him. His colleague Schwartz was just coming downstairs, but on seeing Peter Ivanovich enter he stopped and winked at him, as if to say, "Ivan Illich has made a mess of things, not like you and me." Schwartz's face with his Piccadilly whiskers, and his slim figure in evening dress, had as usual an air of elegant solemnity, which contrasted with the playfulness of his character, and had a special piquancy here,
or so it seemed to Peter Ivanovich. Peter Ivanovich allowed the ladies to precede him and slowly followed them upstairs. Schwartz did not come down but remained where he was, and Peter Ivanovich understood that he wanted to arrange where they should play bridge that evening. The ladies went upstairs to the widow's room, and Schwartz, with seriously compressed lips but a playful look in his eyes, indicated by a twist of his eyebrows the room to the right where the body lay. Peter Ivanovich, like everyone else on such occasions, entered feeling uncertain what he would have to do. All he knew was that at such times it is always safe to cross oneself. But he was not quite sure whether one should make obeisances while doing so. He therefore adopted a middle course. On entering the room he began crossing himself and made a slight movement resembling a bow. At the same time, as far as the motion of his head and arm allowed, he surveyed the room. Two young men, apparently nephews, one of whom was a high school pupil, were leaving the room, crossing themselves as they did so. An old woman was standing motionless, and a lady with strangely arched eyebrows was saying something to her in a whisper. A vigorous, resolute church reader, in a frack coat, was reading something in a loud voice with an expression that precluded any contradiction. The butler's assistant, Jerryson, stepping lightly in front of Peter Ivanovich, was strewing something on the floor. Noticing this, Peter Ivanovich was immediately aware of a faint odour of a decomposing body. The last time he had called on Ivan Illich, Peter Ivanovich had seen Jerryson in the study. Ivan Illich had been particularly fond of him and he was performing the duty of a sick nurse. Peter Ivanovich continued to make the sign of the cross, slightly inclining his head in an intermediate direction between the coffin, the reader, and the icons on the table in a corner of the room. Afterwards, when it seemed to him that this movement of his arm, in crossing himself, had gone on too long, he stopped and began to look at the corpse. The dead man lay, as dead men always lie, in a specially heavy way, his rigid limbs sunk in the soft cushions of the coffin, with the head forever bowed on the pillow. His yellow waxen brow with bald patches over his sunken temples was thrust up in the way peculiar to the dead, the protruding nose seeming to press on the upper lip. He was much changed, and grown even thinner since Peter Ivanovich had last seen him, but, as is always the case with the dead, his face was handsomer, and above all more dignified than when he was alive. The expression on the face said that what was necessary had been accomplished, and accomplished rightly. Besides this, there was in that expression a reproach and a warning to the living. This warning seemed to Peter Ivanovich out of place, or at least not applicable to him. He felt a certain discomfort, and so he hurriedly crossed himself once more, and turned and went out of the door, too hurriedly and too regardless of propriety, as he himself was aware. Schwartz was waiting for him in the adjoining room with legs spread wide apart and both hands toying with his top hat behind his back. The mere sight of that playful, well-groomed, and elegant figure refreshed Peter Ivanovich. He felt that Schwartz was above all these happenings and would not surrender to any depressing influences. His very look said that this incident of a church service for Ivan Illich could not be a sufficient reason for infringing the order of the session, in other words, that it would certainly not prevent his unwrapping a new pack of cards and shuffling them that evening, while a footman placed fresh candles on the table, in fact, that there was no reason for supposing that this incident would hinder their spending the evening agreeably. Indeed, he said this in a whisper, as Peter Ivanovich passed him, proposing that they should meet for a game at Fedor Vasilievich's. But apparently Peter Ivanovich was not destined to play bridge that evening. Praskovya Fedorovna, a short, fat woman, who despite all efforts to the contrary had continued to broaden steadily from her shoulders downwards, and who had the same extraordinarily arched eyebrows as the lady who had been standing by the coffin, dressed all in black, her head covered with lace, came out of her own room with some other ladies, conducted them to the room where the dead body lay, and said, "The service will begin immediately. Please go in." Schwartz, making an indefinite bow, stood still, evidently neither accepting nor declining this invitation. Praskovya Fedorovna, recognizing Peter Ivanovich, sighed, went close up to him, took his hand, and said, "I know you are a true friend to Ivan Illich," and looked at him awaiting some suitable response. And Peter Ivanovich knew that, just as it had been the right thing to cross himself in that room, So what he had to do here was to press her hand, sigh, and say, "Believe me." So he did all this, and as he did it felt that the desired result had been achieved, that both he and she were touched. "Come with me. I want to speak to you before it begins," said the widow. "Give me your arm." Peter Ivanovich gave her his arm and they went to the inner rooms, passing Schwartz, who winked at Peter Ivanovich compassionately. "That does for our bridge. Don't object if we find another player. Perhaps you can cut in when you do escape," said his playful look. Peter Ivanovich sighed still more deeply and despondently, and Praskovya Fedorovna pressed his arm gratefully. When they reached the drawing room, upholstered in pink cretonne and lighted by a dim lamp, they sat down at the table, she on a sofa and Peter Ivanovich on a low pouf, the springs of which yielded spasmodically under his weight. Praskovya Fedorovna had been on the point of warning him to take another seat, but felt that such a warning was out of keeping with her present condition and so changed her mind. As he sat down on the pouf, Peter Ivanovich recalled how Ivan Ilyich had arranged this room, and had consulted him regarding this pink cretonne with green leaves. The whole room was full of furniture and knick-knacks, and on her way to the sofa the lace of the widow's black shawl caught on the edge of the table. Peter Ivanovich rose to detach it, and the springs of the pouf, relieved of his weight, rose also and gave him a push. The widow began detaching her shawl herself, and Peter Ivanovich again sat down, suppressing the rebellious springs of the pouf under him. But the widow had not quite freed herself and Peter Ivanovich got up again, and again the pouf rebelled and even creaked. When this was all over she took out a clean cambric handkerchief and began to weep. The episode with the shawl and the struggle with the pouf had cooled Peter Ivanovich's emotions and he sat there with a sullen look on his face. This awkward situation was interrupted by Sokolov, Ivan Ilyich's butler, who came to report at the plot in the cemetery that Praskovya Fedorovna had chosen would cost 200 rubles. She stopped weeping and, looking at Peter Ivanovich with the air of a victim, remarked in French that it was very hard for her. Peter Ivanovich made a silent gesture signifying his full conviction that it must indeed be so. "Please smoke," she said in a magnanimous yet crushed voice, and turned to discuss with Sokolov the price of the plot for their grave. Peter Ivanovich, while lighting his cigarette, heard her inquiring very circumstantially into the prices of different plots in the cemetery, and finally decide which she would take. When that was done she gave instructions about engaging the choir. Sokolov then left the room. "I look after everything myself," she told Peter Ivanovich, shifting the albums that lay on the table, and noticing that the table was endangered by his cigarette ash, she immediately passed him an ashtray, saying as she did so, "I consider it an affectation to say that my grief prevents my attending to practical affairs. On the contrary, if anything can, I won't say console me, but distract me, it is seeing to everything concerning him." She again took out her handkerchief as if preparing to cry, but suddenly, as if mastering her feeling, she shook herself and began to speak calmly. "But there is something I want to talk to you about." Peter Ivanovich bowed, keeping control of the springs of the pouf, which immediately began quivering under him. "He suffered terribly the last few days."
"Did he?"
said Peter Ivanovich.
"Oh, terribly.
He screamed unceasingly, not for minutes but for hours. For the last 3 days he screamed incessantly. It was unendurable. I cannot understand how I bore it, you could hear him 3 rooms off. Oh, what I have suffered."
"Is it possible that he was conscious all that time?" asked Peter Ivanovich.
"Yes," she whispered. "To the last moment. He took leave of us a quarter of an hour before he died, and asked us to take Volodya away. The thought of the suffering of this man he had known so intimately, first as a merry little boy, then as a schoolmate, and later as a grown-up colleague, suddenly struck Peter Ivanovich with horror, despite an unpleasant consciousness of his own and this woman's dissimulation. He again saw that brow, and that nose pressing down on the lip, and felt afraid for himself. 3 days of frightful suffering and the death. Why, that might suddenly, at any time, happen to me, he thought, and for a moment felt terrified. But, he did not himself know how,
The customary reflection at once occurred to him that this had happened to Ivan Ilyich and not to him, and that it should not and could not happen to him, and that to think that it could would be yielding to depressing, which he ought not to do, as Schwartz's expression plainly showed. After which reflection Peter Ivanovich felt reassured, and began to ask with interest about the details of Ivan Ilyich's death, as though death was an accident natural to Ivan Ilyich but certainly not to himself. After many details of the really dreadful physical sufferings Ivan Ilyich had endured, which details he learnt only from the effect those sufferings had produced on Praskovya Fedorovna's nerves, the widow apparently found it necessary to get to business.
"Oh, Peter Ivanovich, how hard it is! How terribly, terribly hard!" And she again began to weep. Peter Ivanovich sighed and waited for her to finish blowing her nose. When she had done so he said, "Believe me," and she again began talking, and brought out what was evidently her chief concern with him, namely, to question him as to how she could obtain a grant of money from the government on the occasion of her husband's death. She made it appear that she was asking Peter Ivanovich's advice about her pension, but he soon saw that she already knew about the to-the-minutest detail, more even than he did himself. She knew how much could be got out of the government in consequence of her husband's death, but wanted to find out whether she could not possibly extract something more. Peter Ivanovich tried to think of some means of doing so, but after reflecting for a while and, out of propriety, condemning the government for its niggardliness, he said he thought that nothing more could be got. Then she sighed and evidently began to devise means of getting rid of her visitor. Noticing this, he put out his cigarette, rose, pressed her hand, and went out into the anteroom. In the dining room where the clock stood that Ivan Ilyich had liked so much, and had bought at an antique shop, Peter Ivanovich met a priest and a few acquaintances, who had come to attend the service, and he recognized Ivan Ilyich's daughter, a handsome young woman. She was in black and her slim figure appeared slimmer than ever. She had a gloomy, determined, almost angry expression, and bowed to Peter Ivanovich, as though he were in some way to blame. Behind her, with the same offended look, stood a wealthy young man, an examining magistrate, whom Peter Ivanovich also knew and who was her fiancé, as he had heard. He bowed mournfully to them, and was about to pass into the death chamber, when from under the stairs appeared the figure of Ivan Ilyich's schoolboy son, who was extremely like his father. He seemed a little Ivan Ilyich, such as Peter Ivanovich remembered when they studied law together. His tear-stained eyes had in them the look that is seen in the eyes of boys of 13 or 14, who are not pure-minded. When he saw Peter Ivanovich he scowled morosely and shamefacedly. Peter Ivanovich nodded to him and entered the death chamber. The service began, candles, groans, incense, tears, and sobs. Peter Ivanovich stood looking gloomily down at his feet. He did not look once at the dead man, did not yield to any depressing influence, and was one of the first to leave the room. There was no one in the anteroom, but Gerasim darted out of the dead man's room, rummaged with his strong hands among the fur coats, to find Peter Ivanovich's and helped him on with it. "Well, friend Gerasim," said Peter Ivanovich, so as to say something. "It's a sad affair, isn't it? It's God will. We shall all come to it some day," said Gerasim, displaying his teeth, the even white teeth of a healthy peasant, and, like a man in the thick of urgent work, he briskly opened the front door, called the coachman, helped Peter Ivanovich into the sledge, and sprang back to the porch, as if in readiness for what he had to do next. Peter Ivanovich found the fresh air particularly pleasant after the smell of incense, the dead body, and carbolic acid. "Where to, sir?" asked the coachman. "It's not too late even now, I'll call round on Fedor Vialevich." He accordingly drove there and found them just finishing the first rubber, so that it was quite convenient for him to cut in.